Michael, greetings. Michael, what's for breakfast?
Didn't hear you.
I know. He's just eating away. He probably has us on mute. He's got more important things to do. All right, another 2 minutes and then we'll get this going. Let me see who's here. Pen. Michael, Jennifer, Annika. Christine Austin, is she gonna join today? Annika?
Yeah,
I'm on.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't see your picture anywhere. Oh, there you are. Okie doke. Christy Petrenko. There she is. Cristiano. Claire. Joanne's here. Jeff, I heard him. Jeff's there. Johan and Scott's there. Johan? And Miguel, Sarah, there she is. Tatiana, Leia's there, Tina there, Rajesh, Mike Suddy, Susan Smith, Tom Donaldson or Kathy. Hannigan. Oh, there's Tom. Johan.
Definitely.
Hannigan, Savage. There's Savage. James Reynolds, Sarah Joe, Bill Dunty. I saw him and Joe Wang. So Mike Suddy. Tatiana. Claire, Christiana, and that's everybody. Oh, Christiana's there. So we're just missing Claire.
No, you're not.
Oh, there you are. All right. And Tatiana, but Leah's here. So, sorry. All right. Jill, you want to talk about the meeting in June?
Sure. So we're going to meet for 3 days in June via Zoom, and from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Pacific on each of those days. And those dates are June 1st, 2nd, and 8th. I'll also take a minute and just remind you that for the majority of you, your NIH progress reports, our PPRs are due April 1st, and please email me a final copy of that PDF once you've submitted it. Thanks.
Yeah, we had to split the meeting up into several days. I'm not sure we'll use all the time or that it'll go to 1 p.m. every day, because some people will have to drop in and out of the call, but it'll be kind of like the last Zoom meeting we did. We'll send out an agenda for it so that people can prepare their PowerPoints and get those in ahead of time. I'd like to do the Data Access Committee and the Publication Committee if they're ready, and then we can. The main item on the agenda today is to hear the third UH2 project that was recently funded and into CFAS. So Sarah, you got your anything for the publications committee? You're still muted.
Yes, you want me to go now?
Yeah, please.
Okay, it will be very, very quick. Hold on. Okay. We have no concept proposals, manuscript submissions, or post-acceptance forms this month, but we did have one paper that was cited, that cited CFAS from the Jacobsons, who regularly cite CFAS, which we appreciate. So I just want to encourage everyone to submit their concept proposals and update us on progress. And if you have any questions, please reach out because we can help you with the process, especially for those of you who are new. All right, that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, I plan on inviting the Jacobsons to present some of their data because the data they're collecting were collected with CFAS samples, and they continue to cite that as a source of funding. So it's appreciated, and I think they've been publishing quite a bit lately, and so it'd be good to hear from what they have going on in their lab.
Yeah, Leah, I think that would be nice.
About anything from the Data Access Committee?
We haven't had any new requests for data other than Susan Smith, and I think she had to go back to her IRB for a few things. I did want to let everyone know, you probably got an email from Indiana University saying that the Box system is being migrated over to Microsoft, and we've just finished migrating all of the data sets. So I will be emailing people soon with instructions on how to use the new data set. And I have a few questions that I would like the Data Access Committee to just weigh in on. So I'll be emailing you in the next day or two with that. That's all I have.
Okay. Any important announcements from NIAAA, from Joe or Bill? Anything new in the world of FAS or?
No, from me, this is Joe, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add, Ed, thanks.
All right, there is, Tom, you probably have information on a legislative push that's being sponsored by Senator Murkowski.
Ed, that's right. NOFAS has actually formed a policy team, and Susan Carlson heads that up. And there should be a bill introduced, I would say, mid-April. That's Murkowski and Amy Klobuchar, the Minnesota senator, and then Betty McCollum, Minnesota congresswoman, and Don Young from Alaska on the House side. So that bill, probably the end of next week, will go out to the agencies. Now it is the Advancing FASD Research Services and Prevention Act, but of course under research and NIAAA, it just merely includes the line of continuing the FASD program. So there are no further details. There are additional details for CDC, HRSA, SAMHSA, and also the Departments of Education and Justice. So NOFAS is working with, I think now over a dozen states. We've had meetings to round up the advocates in those states and then prepare them for meetings with congressional staff or the members themselves. So we'll be going through that process in the coming months.
So when that's complete, then we can weigh in to our senators, et cetera, to try to get them to sign on.
That's right. We have an action alert that'll come out probably a week ahead of the introduction of the bill, and some more information just about, of course, the bill text, all the details, and who to reach out to. We have sort of a directory of all health staff. And we're also submitting some appropriations requests to try to increase the number for FA. It's actually, the account is still FAS at CDC, so to try to bump that number up a little bit, and also HRSA. And just opportunistically, because of some relationships with members, we're also submitting some requests through the Defense Health Agency, so through the Department of Defense, for a peer-to-peer research project, which is an account where there's an opportunity to include some language.
And the last thing is, I guess there's an ICC FASD meeting coming up. I forget the exact date when that is, but that's an open meeting to the public. So, do you remember the date, Bill?
I'm looking right now. I think it's, I'll put it in the chat when I find it.
Okie doke, thanks. All right, so the main item today is gonna hear about the third UH2 proposal. And so I am interested in hearing, because I know a little bit about it, but very just in basically a title. Who wants to go first? Christine or Annika? Annika, you're up first.
I would love to go first, and hopefully I can screen share.
Yeah, not a problem, I hope.
Would be good.
Jill's got this down, I think.
Oops, wrong. Okay. Don't want to give it away before I start.
Oh, well, let me do it so people know who you are. I'm sorry. Annika is an epidemiologist and a pharmacologist, and she's been interested in perinatal drug exposure, and in particular, in Native Americans and health disparity issues with the group. She's a PhD from the University of California in San Diego State in public health and epidemiology, and she's currently a postdoctoral scholar, but she's more than that, in the Department of Pediatrics at UCSD. She's got an impressive list of publications and has a standing interest in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, as you can imagine, working with Tina and Ken and Miguel. So I've known Annika for a while, and I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say. Christine Austin, I don't think we've met. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Environmental Medicine and Public Health at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. She is in the Institute for Exposomic Research, which is new to me, and the Transdisciplinary Center for Early Environmental Exposures, which is funded by the NIEHS. She's developing novel analytic techniques to reconstruct environmental exposures during prenatal and perinatal periods using spatially mapped biomarkers in baby teeth. And I think that's, we're gonna hear some of that today. And obviously the importance of biomarkers in fetal alcohol is critical. She won the she won the 2017 Career Development Grant from the Una Shriver National Institute on Child Health and Human Development. She's a graduate of postdoctoral at the University of Sydney, and she's held positions at Harvard, the University of Sydney, and got her PhD from the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. So welcome to CFAS to both of you. And I hope you find it an enriching and enjoyable experience, and not too difficult to get along with everybody here. I think we have a good group of people that seem to get along these days. So I'll turn it over to you now.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ed. I appreciate that. We're honored to be here, actually kind of giddy to be here, and to work with this consortium on the development of biomarkers in baby teeth that predict neurobehavioral performance in kids with FASD. So we'll be peering back into the black box of pregnancy to tease out specific disruptions of fetal development. And as this consortium is well aware, we need biomarkers of PAE. If we had non-invasive, objective, retrospective, sensitive biomarkers of prenatal alcohol exposure, it would allow us to identify children with PAE to precisely target interventions and treatment and support, and to better understand how and when specific damage occurs, and to more effectively link exposures to outcomes, and to understand the interactions among exposures that might lead to mitigation of damage using, for example, timely nutritional supplements. So if these biomarkers could be assessed using readily available sample sources, and if multiple co-exposures, especially those sharing common biochemical pathways with alcohol, could be assessed simultaneously, and if we could be sure that they reflected the fetal exposure, not the maternal exposure, that would be even better. And in this study, we proposed naturally shed deciduous teeth as a novel source of tissue for assessing just this kind of biomarker, reflecting both prenatal and postnatal exposure. So the first of our specific aims is to determine the sensitivity and specificity of our proposed markers. We hypothesize that sensitivity and specificity will be 90 and 100% respectively. Having done so, aim two will assess associations among the magnitude and timing of exposure and neurobehavioral deficits. We know that magnitude and gestational timing is critical, and some time-sensitive windows are well delineated, but those for neurobehavioral effects are more difficult to study, partly because brain development occurs throughout the pregnancy and it continues postnatally. So another advantage of using teeth as sample tissue is that it allows us to look both prenatally and postnatally. We broadly hypothesize that more severe outcomes will be associated with increased magnitude or duration of exposure. Aim three is to explore interactions between alcohol and metals, and we'll quantify co-exposures to selected metals, both neurotoxins like lead and essential metals like manganese and zinc, and explore modification of the effects of alcohol on neurodevelopment. And in aim four, in recognition that alcohol rarely occurs in isolation, is to explore biomarkers of co-exposures, including cannabis, tobacco, and opioids. The team that's going to accomplish our aims includes CFAS PIs Sarah Mattson and her group at SDSU, and Jeffrey Wozniak and his group at UMN, Christine at Mount Sinai, along with Manish Arora and Siam Andra, and Tina and Ken with me at UCSD. So how are we going to carry out this study? The CFAS PIs will facilitate recruitment by contacting eligible families to obtain permission to approach. We'll recruit 50 dyads, 25 cases, and 25 controls, carrying out all the aspects remotely. We'll ask families to send us naturally shed teeth and allow us to access already collected neurobehavioral data. Our outcome variables include neurodevelopmental outcomes and our novel biomarkers. And Christine will talk more about the specific dental biomarkers. But why do we think we can do this? So, well, we did a pilot study where we recruited 31 families and collected 16 sample sets. We show the sources here just to point out how amazing NOFAS is. NOFAS members responded to our request for teeth with enthusiasm. And I'm really glad that Tom is here to see this too. We first worked with the Dorstein lab at UCSD, but they weren't able to pick up an adequate signal. They used LCMS and powdered samples or pulverized samples. Then we linked in with Manish Arora's lab and Christine, and voila, we have proof of concept. And at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Christine. Christine, you're already introduced, assistant professor in the Department of Environmental Medicine and Public Health in the ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, where she does really exciting work developing biomarkers in baby teeth.
Thank you, Annika, and it's a pleasure to meet you all and join CFAS. I'll start off with just giving you a brief overview of tooth development so you understand why we would want to use teeth. Teeth begin forming or begin mineralizing in the second trimester, and they grow following an incremental pattern, basically forming growth rings much like a tree. A very prominent growth ring forms at birth, which acts as a timestamp, allowing us to apply a timeline to the other growth rings that we find in the tooth. As the tooth is mineralizing, circulating chemicals are deposited in those growth rings. So that means that while the tooth is growing through that very critical prenatal and early childhood period, it's basically archiving what, how much, and when an exposure occurred. So the primary teeth, they can be collected non-invasively when they fall out anywhere from 6 to 13 years of age, which is obviously an age where a diagnosis of FASD would lead to optimal intervention and treatment for affected children.
Is that right? Okay.
And so actually, before we did any preliminary analysis, we'd come across this paper here by Dr. Zarin and colleagues, where they actually demonstrated that you could detect ethylglucuronide, or ETG, which is a direct biomarker of alcohol consumption. And this they measured in adult teeth. And they found that ETG in adult teeth was significantly correlated with alcohol intake as measured by a questionnaire designed to identify alcohol dependency. This study actually required the pulverization of the entire adult tooth, which completely destroys all that growth information that's left in those incremental layers. In order to preserve that very precious timing information, we've actually built our own robot to microsample the dentine within those growth zones. The microsected growth zones are then processed for analysis by mass spectrometry. And to give you an idea of what we're working with, so the Zeren study required 50 milligrams of tooth powder, whereas in our pilot study, we were able to measure as small quantities as 2 to 6 milligrams. And that actually represents the prenatal area. So this is some preliminary data, which we included in our grant submission. And this is just chromatography mass spec. And we're just showing that you've got the standard in panel A of ETS and ETG. That's ethyl glucuronide and ethyl sulfate, both direct markers of alcohol exposure. And you can see that they're clearly detectable in the standard, not detectable in the blank, which is in panel B. And then we had a case and a control tooth. We looked at the prenatal areas of both, and we were able to detect ETS and ETG in the case tooth and not in the control tooth. Some further method development is required to add markers of, other markers of alcohol exposure. These include things like fatty acid ethyl esters, phosphatidyl ethanol, as well as increased sensitivity, because at the moment, our preliminary data was just looking at the whole prenatal area, but we would like to get this down to trimester or even monthly levels. We also aim to develop this method to measure biomarkers of possible co-exposures to tobacco and drugs of abuse, targets that have also already previously been detected in pulverized whole teeth. Another way to kind of get at this is to do a what we call indirect or untargeted approach. And so here we can actually use the same samples, but using a different mass spectrometer, we can look at metabolomics. And so that gives us an idea of kind of like markers of biological response to the exposure. And again, in our preliminary study, we compared pre and postnatal dentine fractions between cases and controls. And this was to identify metabolites with major differences between case and control. So our results indicated a dysregulation of amino acids in the tooth from the FASD diagnosed participant compared to the control, as well as a dramatic increase in cholesterol sulfate, which is a component of cell membranes where it has a stabilizing role. So while these markers are less specific to alcohol exposure, they may predict FASD outcomes or severity of outcomes, and they give a more global view of the effects of early life alcohol exposure on different metabolic networks. And just to give you an idea, on the right are some of the metabolic networks that were associated with the metabolites we detected in the tooth. So this is actually where my main expertise lies. So our lab at Sinai first developed tooth-based biomarkers of metal exposure, and we have validated the neurotoxicant lead, as well as essential elements like manganese, against other matrices, both in human and animal models. The measurement of metals in teeth actually uses a laser to sample the growth rings, so we're able to achieve a much higher weekly resolution of measurements. Exposure to metals is ubiquitous, and there's a vast body of literature showing that prenatal metal exposure can disrupt neurodevelopment, even at very low levels. So in previous studies, we've actually shown that reduced uptake of manganese and zinc and a higher uptake of lead during specific early life windows was associated with autism spectrum disorder. There are currently no studies exploring the interactions of metals and PAE and their joint effects on neurodevelopment. Our study will address this and explore those interactions over time, identifying the timing of interneuron exposure associated with the highest susceptibility to neurodevelopment impairment in childhood. So as a summary of our key outcomes, at the end of this study, we hope to have demonstrated that PAE can be detected and quantified by gestational timing in teeth. We plan to validate specific biomarkers of PAE, so things like ETG and ETS, as well as assess associations among the timing and magnitude of PAE and neurodevelopmental outcomes. This will demonstrate a workflow to measure co-exposures that interact or modify PAE effects. And we hope that with this data that we generate from this study, we'll be able to prepare a U or R01 application for expanding this to a larger study size. So just a brief overview of our timeline. In year one of this project, we will focus on recruitment and method development and aim to complete analysis of tooth samples early in year two so that we can finalize data analysis in the first half of year two. This will allow us time to prepare the RO-UO1 application and disseminate results before the end of year two. I think that's everything, unless Annika has anything to add, but thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Annika, any last comments?
Oh, no. I think we're just very excited about doing this.
Then I'll open it up to questions. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Dan Savage here. This is very exciting work. Two quick questions. One, I'm curious as to how you visualize the rings in your cross sections for the laser. And then the second question is, did you mention ethyl sulfide as another biomarker that you could look at? I wasn't sure.
Yes, ethyl sulfate is one that we're going to look for. I think. Let me just pull up the preliminary data. I think we were able to detect that in the preliminary data. ETS, we were able to detect that in the tooth. And in visualizing the growth rings, so what we normally do is when we cut the tooth in half, we can normally see the neonatal line. And actually to kind of speed things up a little bit, rather than looking for the individual growth rings, we use some kind of literature values for how much the tooth is growing to kind of estimate where certain growth rings are. Otherwise, we have to take a thin section and use histology.
Okay, thank you.
I had a quick comment. Oops. Sorry, Mike, go ahead. Just a comment. It strikes me this could be really interesting and an important way to look at things like co-occurring risks, like for lead or things like that, and see if they map to both outcomes.
This is Michael Charnas, and this is a really exciting development. I wondered how you are planning to correlate your findings in teeth with histories to get some sense of the quantitative relationship between levels and timing of drinking and what you see. And a corollary question is, have you done or are you familiar with animal studies that have tried to be more quantitative and more specific about periods of exposure and levels of these metabolites in teeth?
I should speak to some of that and can divide it up. Let's see. So I'll let you speak to the animal studies. I think part of the problem, you're right, with correlating the what we're finding with the biomarkers and with the actual exposure history. Part of the problem there is that many of the children, even in these cohorts, are either foster or adopted, and so we don't have those histories. So we're focusing on people where we would have a better history. But at this point, the alternative to going with what we can find about some people and working with that is to just go based off of the diagnoses. So you're right that this is an area that's really tricky. We have hope that working with the few people that do have adequate histories, we'll be able to be a little more sure about what we're finding. But part of this will also be teasing out from the teeth what we can find. There's also, we do have some plans in the future to work with an Australian cohort that has a greater proportion of birth mothers. So that's another option for the future.
So I guess before we get to the animal study, I mean, we do have longitudinal studies, the Ukraine study, where there is information ascertained during pregnancy about drinking. And those children are followed to the age where they start losing their baby teeth. So maybe there's an opportunity to collaborate with Tina and to be able to do some of that tighter correlation and to cross-correlate with some of the other measures of exposure and risk that some of the people on the screen have been able to produce.
Absolutely, and we've spoken about that. And I think those children are just now reaching an age where this might be possible.
In regards to the animal models, none that I'm aware of. The only studies I've seen where people have been measuring organic biomarkers in teeth have been adult studies. In terms of markers of alcohol exposure, the Zarin study was the only one we were aware of that actually measured alcohol exposure biomarkers in teeth.
So I would, again, as you'll see, CFAS covers a range of clinical, translational, and preclinical work. And we do have people who are giving alcohol to zebrafish and mice, and maybe, I don't know about fish teeth, but certainly, Scott Parnell is dosing mice at well-defined periods, and there may be an opportunity rather than just discarding the mouse with the teeth to send you teeth. So that's another collaborative opportunity, I think. And you know, the advantage of that is that we have really good outcomes. Scott and Johan both have really good outcomes that would allow you to correlate your findings with specific markers.
That'd very be exciting.
Yeah.
Tina and I have talked about this in the past. And so there you go. Yeah, so I think we're interested.
I'm assuming you do lots of teeth and other types of projects on the neurotoxins, et cetera. I don't know how hard it is to do these assays, but you could literally look at exposures in the general population to see what percent of women are drinking while they're pregnant, which is something why we have some data on. It's all over the map of what percent of women are drinking second, third trimesters. And that's, I guess, all you can do is a second, third trimester. But that would be important data just to get a good indication of how many women continue to drink, while they're pregnant. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
This is Susan. I had two questions for you. The first is, does your metal methodology, also laser detection, also detect iron in that list of minerals?
Iron is a difficult one. The technique we have has a very, has a calcium-based interference, so we're having trouble detecting iron.
That's really unfortunate because our data suggests that iron would actually be sequestered by alcohol, and so you might not see as much. My second question is, have you considered correlating your data against morphology? Because the dentin in the pulp of tooth, of course, are derived from neural crest, and so they're neural crest derived. And there's some recent suggestions that perhaps some of the enamel is neural crest as well. So there may be an opportunity to identify correlations, since those same cells that are creating the face are also contributing to the tooth formation.
I had not thought of that. That would be very interesting. We can definitely, we can think about maybe taking like a micro CT scan or somehow 3D image the tooth before we cut it open. Something we could definitely do.
Yeah, it might also affect the rings that are growing. And because then, you're thinking maybe those are smaller stem cells like this. So, yeah, that's cool. Thanks.
Any other questions? Well,
I've got a question, Ed, real quick. Sorry if you've answered this already, but I guess how long are these teeth viable after they're shed using your technology? Can parents go back into the drawer and pull out their kids' baby teeth to donate them, those kind of questions for future projects?
Yeah, I mean, we're still learning about organics material, but I mean, the metals are stable for, I mean, we've analyzed teeth from Neanderthals. So the metals are stable for thousands and thousands of years. I know there are some studies that have extracted proteins from fossil teeth. So we believe the organics are also stable. Definitely thinking about people that currently have teeth in their drawers, I think there'd be no problem detecting the alcohol exposure biomarkers in those.
Okay, any other questions? Well, Joe and Bill, I want to thank you and congratulate you on choosing three UH2 projects that seem to fit nicely into CFAS. And so you know that I was a critic of the technique of the way it was all done, but you guys did a great job. So thank you.
Yeah, I would add that I do want to thank Joe for his leadership throughout this whole process. And it does show that NIH and NIAAA can get things done correctly. So
I've been reflecting on this too. And, you know, when we started CFAS back in 2002 and, you know, eventually got funded in 2003, these were all romantic relationships. And what NIH has done is essentially provided arranged marriages for us. I was interested in Ed sort of saying, well, I think I know one of these people. I've really never met the other, but now you're part of this group. And my understanding, and I'm certainly not expert in this, is that the track record in the real world with arranged marriages is no worse than the track record with romantically determined marriages. And so I'm really
bursting with enthusiasm, huh?
Yes. No, I'm delighted with the choices that NIH has made for us. You know, I'm glad to welcome all of the new UH2 people to the group, because I'm not sure we would have done that well if we had done this on our own. And by that, I mean the diversity of research areas that have been added to CFAS that, just from the discussion today, really reflect on the opportunities for collaboration and for growth of the consortium. So I want to thank Joe and Bill for their perseverance and their insight in choosing well for us.
Thank you, Michael. I still may critique it eventually, you know, down the road, but we'll see. All right. Are there any other issues or questions that people have? I think Bill put up something on the chat. About the ICC meeting. And if you've never been to one, it's interesting, to say the least. All right, so we have about 20 minutes left or so. So I'll just ask for volunteers if they have any new and exciting data that they would like to present. No one has any new and exciting data.
We have unrelated data that I'll just convey for people who have not been vaccinated, which is that we did a study of our healthcare system during Boston's most recent surge. And we showed that if you look at a life table analysis comparing people who are vaccinated to people who are unvaccinated, that the 95% confidence intervals separate at 7 days after the first shot of Moderna. We're a Moderna site, and that at 3 weeks, we see a 90% decrease in the incidence of SARS-CoV-2 infections after the first dose. So for those of you who have booked tickets to Florida for spring break and have not yet been vaccinated, just maybe wait about 14 days and off you go.
Good to know. Bob, good to travel and go places, huh?
Still wear a mask.
I'm going to Hawaii in 2 weeks. So I'm getting my first big trip out of town. So, all right, no one else has data. Jeff, you got anything exciting going on?
Nothing that I haven't talked about already. We're still plugging away collecting data. No, nothing exciting.
Anyone else? All right.
I've been working with Leah and Jeff both to integrate Brain Online in their sites, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, the one thing that we have to start doing is to discuss the possibility of CFAST 5 and topics and directions that CFAST might go. And I am interested in any ideas that you might have and ideas for investigators that you might like to see involved in CFAST. One of the issues that we're going to be facing is diversity in investigators as well as subject populations. It's nice to see Annika, who I know deals with Native Americans, but we also have to consider other populations as well as the diversity of our members of CFAST. So any ideas that people have of, in particular, younger scientists, because, well, I look around, there are some old people here. So, you know, we need to get some fresh ideas and move forward. So I'm open to any suggestions because I think we're going to have to start moving on this within the next couple of months to
I would say, given the success that we've just had with these three UH2s, my proposal would be that Bill and Joe identify the researchers for this next round and write the grant.
I'm all in favor of that. You know, the one problem or an issue that I saw, and it came up in the timeline of Annika's project, is that they won't have data until the end of the second year, where CFAST application is going to be due before that. And Bill and I will have to talk about if we want to incorporate some of these into UO1s, how we go about doing that, whether it can be put in with a delayed start or whatever. You know, but I think, you know, that's something. These UH2s are supposed to, in fact, foster, you know, either an R01 or become a part of CFAST. And yet the timing of this latest round will be out of sync to come in at with the project beginning the same time everyone else's project would begin. So
What is the suggested timing right now?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we can provide those details just yet, but we're hoping to in the near future. Yeah, Ed, I do hear you in terms of the latest round of UH2s being out of sync. It was just something that was beyond our control, yeah. But there could be some things that we put in place to help address that. In a potential renewal.
Ed?
Yeah.
This is Ken. And this is a totally different subject, but the issue of prevention is intriguing as far as this group is concerned. And I'm wondering if Bill or someone can talk a little bit about what you're thinking about, and maybe you too, Ed, what you're thinking about as far as a proposal that looks at prevention.
Bill?
Well, this is NIAAA's opinion, is that prevention is a very important aspect of our research portfolio. It's one that has unfortunately been neglected over the last few years. And when I mean neglected, we just have not had many projects in that area funded. We took recently steps to help address that, which was the issuing of funding opportunity announcements related to interventions and prevention projects, which I think we've circulated that information. Putting on my project scientist hat, I would hope that you all consider prevention projects. I think I would echo Joe's beliefs that prevention is extremely important, and it's something that we as a consortium have not addressed recently. So I wouldn't discount those projects.
Bill, do you anticipate that the budget for this next round will be larger than the budget that we have seen before? Because as we have discussed, the prevention studies tend to be disproportionately costly.
Yeah, Michael, I can't really comment on it other than to say that we're taking it into consideration. We're having those discussions right now. And hopefully the budget will allow for not only prevention studies, but intervention studies, which I think the PIs have prioritized in the past, at least verbally. And we know the community is desperately wanting more of. So we can't say anything right now, but we are under discussion with our leadership.
So I think that's very helpful, because I know that, you know, when this was discussed at council, there were a number of buzzwords. Prevention was one of them. As we discussed last time, diversity was another. And so was early diagnosis and intervention. And that covers a pretty broad spectrum. in rookie grants, people always complain about being overly ambitious and unfocused. And we would want to submit something that has the opportunity to really move the field forward, but also to be successful.
In terms of prevention, I mean, I'm a complete novice in the area, but after that call came out about prevention, I looked and saw what was out there. And there have been a number of projects to show that you can, in fact, intercede and change pregnant women's drinking or women of childbearing ages drinking. The problem is I couldn't find anyone who's really implemented those. So the research studies, some funded by CDC, Project Choices, whatever, they're very effective. But if you try to find anyone who does Project Choices outside of a research setting, it just hasn't been implemented, which brings up Sarah Jo's major issue, is that we really need some help with implementation of getting our research out into the field. And so, I mean, I was going to talk to Bill about including an implementation part of the admin core. Both UCSD and SDSU have programs in implementation science. So we could easily access people who may be able to help us.
But that gets you over into policy and things like that, Ed. I mean,
well, but George has called for that. I mean, George has literally said, Ed, what are you doing? Get your stuff out in the field. You know, you're doing all this work, but what's it doing to improve the lives of individuals with FASD? So, I mean, that's a challenge. And, you know, if grant reviewers don't like it, they don't like it, but it's, you know, it's what we're ultimately striving for. I don't think any of us are striving to write another paper.
Right. So, you know, one of the real challenges that we know of from existing literature is that the people who drink the most are the ones who are least likely to benefit from interventions. And they're the ones who also are exposing fetuses to the highest and most prolonged levels of prenatal alcohol. And I think that, you know, if we were, I'm not proposing this, but if we were to write a proposal that was centered around prevention, it would behoove us to again look at the more challenging populations to deal with, which are populations that are struggling with poverty, communities of color, and, you know, again, getting back into the diversity question, people where health disparities are already pronounced, and where many more variables besides prenatal alcohol exposure are adversely influencing childhood development.
Look at Therese Grant's work in Seattle. They have had really good studies of how to intervene with the most high-risk women and women at risk who are either themselves at FAS or at risk. And they've done very lovely work.
You can't find anyone who's implemented that work, even though it's fantastic, shows a higher degree of success. It's just done within that setting in Seattle.
So that's because somebody has to fund it.
Right, so here's a really interesting point, which is that our current interventional work, coincidentally, is the implementation of another Seattle project, which, you know, Christy and Cristiano chose to invest in implementing. And maybe because we really aren't going to be funded at a level to design an implementation process, that maybe the approach could be to design a prevention process. Maybe the approach could be to design an implementation process and, you know, pick four or five sites around the US and take something that works, like Therese's project, and look at how to implement it in four or five diverse communities. And by diverse, I mean now, one like Atlanta, one like Seattle, in other words, communities where conditions are very different, to see what universal benefits there are in implementing a program and what challenges you would need to overcome to implement a program where you have cultural and health disparity barriers that might have made it easier to do in one place than in another. So in other words, rather than inventing the wheel, how about putting the wheel on the car and trying to make it run?
There is one really interesting example in Canada. Laurie Vitale Cox, who many of you know from the FASD conferences, works within an indigenous community in the East and has developed a whole series of tools within the community, a medicine wheel to describe health and healthcare, two-eyed seeing using a traditional approach and a Western approach, et cetera, and working within the community, bringing in community leaders, and has had a major impact in reducing the rate of drinking in her community, in those communities. So there are some examples that could be adapted. And there's an example where you have a marginalized population, a disproportionately affected population, and where approaches that took into account those cultural differences and worked within the community really have made a difference. And I think it's a model that could be adapted for other communities.
Why hasn't been it adopted elsewhere?
Well, I don't know. You know, she's working as a clinician within that community, doing what she's doing on very little money with very little support, et cetera, because that's what happens in those communities. So yes, my group is working with her. Tammy and Charlize are working with her. They have a CIHR grant to begin to reach out to communities and provide education on prenatal alcohol effects within the communities, indigenous communities particularly, to try to intervene and prevent. So there's a model. We could maybe bring that to here as a further way of looking at things.
The other thing you need to do is go back to, we did in the 90s an extensive work in these areas with polydrug exposure, cocaine exposure, et cetera, et cetera. There was NIDA funded a zillion projects on which there is data. So there is very little difference in what you were describing, Michael, and these other projects. And there's no point in us deciding to go find out again what we already found out in 1996, because the data is just sitting there and it's a vast amount of it. So anything that we decided to do differently would have to be based on this really quite a large data set that already exists.
Well, maybe we need to hear about that, bring that to the forum.
Yeah, and it's a huge area of
work. Ed, maybe for our next call, we can invite a couple of people who have done this work to present it. Because I think the message I was trying to convey is what Claire has just reiterated, which is we don't need to invent the wheel here. There are some models out there. I don't think we would want to test five different models, but I think it would be valuable to look at an implementation project with what looks like the most promising and versatile model in a number of settings. And conceivably, that wouldn't be as costly as developing a model.
Bill, is that under NIAAA purview or HRSA purview?
Implementation science?
Yeah.
Well, the research behind it is under NIH's purview. And I was actually pulling up, there was a recent NICHD meeting from the NICHD Office of Global Health. I'll forward that. It just talks about how some of the NIH institutes like NICHD and NCI are interested in implementation science.
As is SAMHSA.
So you can't bring something to the field if you don't determine that what you're bringing to the field works when you take it out of a controlled trial and move it into the messy world of clinical medicine. And, it would be helpful to verify that this is something that NIH would consider to be within its purview before we move forward in thinking about this. But I think it would be helpful to learn more about it. The fact that that's not the work that most, I know, John, you've been involved in some of this, but most of us have not. It would really help us to understand what's out there that's promising that just simply, was left on the tabletop because there was no next step. No funding for the next step.
All right, we got a few minutes left, so I'm going to ask the SAB if they have any comments. Sarah, Joe, how to leave, but Dan or John, James,
I have nothing to add today. I'm also excited about the new developmental projects.
Dan or James?
As am I, about the new projects. I'm looking forward to seeing them develop.
James?
Nothing that to add right now. And I'm sorry, I also have to have another call starting in a minute, so I'm going to have to sign off.
Okay. Bill and Joe, any last comments?
I do have one comment. If you haven't read Dr. Koob's pledge to support the NIH Unite program, I just put a link to it in the chat. It's also found on our NIAAA webpage. It's an important program, and NIAAA has voiced its support. So I encourage you to take a look at it.
I don't know if Joe's still on or not. Okay, any other last comments then? Concerns, issues, send me ideas and potential PIs. So we can start reaching out to people.
And I have just one thing I want to add, unrelated to CFAS, but I'm going to be giving a lecture on FASD for the RSA lecture series, so I'll be asking many of you to provide some slides and information, so just a heads up.
You faded out there for a second. It was the RSA lecture series, I think.
Yes. So just I'll be reaching out to members to get some slides to add to that, so I'm just giving you a heads up.
All righty, thank you. Everybody stay safe and have a good one. All right.
Thanks.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.